Are your school days out of sight? When you took English, art, and math, what's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger for disgusting Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your high school reading list. I'm John McCoy, and with me this time is co-host Rosalind Vastias.
Hi, John.
Hi, Rosalind. You want to tell everyone out there a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Thanks for having me on. I'm a poet. I've been writing since I was 14, and I also have a day job, and I do some side work with a writing organization here in Providence called Frequency Writers, and we run community writing workshops in the city of Providence and for the general Rhode Island community. I didn't actually read much Dickens until I was 30 years old, but Tale of Two Cities was actually a novel that my dad taught in high school. And when I read it the first time, it was not my favorite. So reading it again for this podcast, I actually grew to like it a little more. I think I'll be revisiting it again.
As you mentioned, we are doing this time Charles Dickens' A Tale of Two Cities. I would say this is one of probably about three major Dickens works that gets taught in high school the most. I would say this gets taught, Oliver Twist gets taught a lot, and Great Expectations gets taught a lot. Which one you get is kind of luck of the draw. This is actually, strangely enough, one of Dickens' shorter novels. Compared to just to some of his work, but we've been reading this, I think, now for a couple months between the two of us. We planned to do this a while back, and then one thing or another got in our way personally. But I think also just I underestimated how long Dickens was. Did you find it difficult to read this time?
Yeah, I absolutely underestimated. I remember this novel probably because the main characters to me seem so thin. I remember it being kind of an easy read and not as engaging as other Dickens that I've read. So revisiting it, I was kind of shocked. And I was shocked, I think, that anyone could ever do this with high school students. I was trying to imagine myself reading this book at age 15. And like I said, I didn't come to Dickens until I was much, much older. And I felt like it had been a gap. Like I had missed out a little bit by not reading many Victorians. And I was really delighted with him when I was 30. But that was after doing a Master of Fine Arts program in creative writing. And I really, I think, appreciated his sentences and his style and his weird, digressive plots much more than I would have at the age of 15 or 16.
Yeah, I have a kind of a funny relationship with Dickens, which is I can remember back in, I think it was 1980, the RSC in London did a production of Nicholas Nickleby that was somewhat infamous. It's infamous because it ran for 10 hours, I think, was the time. They just put the entire book on stage, and they had a break for an intermission, and they had like a break for dinner. And so you just kind of went to the theater all day. And as a kid, this idea charmed me so much, I thought, I've got to read this novel. And I went out and I read Nicholas Nickleby, which is a kind of a weird book.
I still haven't read that one.
Do you remember the author's card game where you had cards and it was basically Old Maid sort of, but the idea was you got the cards that were associated with a specific author, and they had the four Charles Dickens book, and the four Charles Dickens books were The Pickwick Papers, Oliver Twist, David Copperfield, and A Christmas Carol. And so I had this idea as a kid that the author's cards would not lie to me. These must have been the most important books by Dickens. And I went out and I read all those. Pickwick Papers is not, I think, a major novel. I don't know why that was on there. But I read those, and then I read a whole bunch of Dickens. And I think Tale of Two Cities was the last of these novels I read. And it felt very different to me from all the other Dickens books. And now that I'm older, I can see exactly why. You know, it was his attempt to write a historical novel. And
yes.
None of his other works were like, I mean, well, actually, he did one other book that was a historical novel that nobody reads. It's a very strange book. I'll give you that. Yeah, a lot of what you say is true. The characters are kind of flat.
The main characters are very flat. I think the supporting characters are pretty fabulous. so it's kind of a letdown to have like this romantic lead that is very sort of cookie cutter and kind of just sort of do-goodery and kind of hard to attach to as human beings. They seem a little too idealized to me most of the time. But I think the supporting characters are pretty wonderful. And I would actually love to see, I wish someone would do like some fanfic treatment of Madame Defarge. I think that would be pretty fun.
Well, everyone loves Madame Defarge. This time through, I fell in love with Miss Pross.
Oh, I know. She's so great. Yeah. Right. I adore her. She is just the best. And I think, not to bring up my dad too much, but I think he really loves her too.
Okay. I'm going to give a really brief overview, and you can jump in, correct me about some things. Like a lot of Dickens novels, it's just full of characters, and they're in addition to the couple dozen major characters, there's probably two or three dozen minor characters
and secret identities,
and there's characters who show up at the beginning of the novel that show up at the end of the novel, and they expect you to remember who these people were or why they're important. Given that this was published as all of Dickens' novels were published in installments, I think Victorians had a lot more patience for this sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And better memories, maybe. I have to like look back a lot of times and try to figure out like, oh, where did this character appear before and who are they and do I remember?
So this book was published in 1859. Although it deals with the years before the storming of the Bastille in 1789, and then just it probably goes about a few months after that, but it's probably starting somewhere around, I would say, 1785 or so. They do mention the American Revolution early in the book, so that's already passed.
Yes.
So here let's talk about what happens in this book. This is the story of the titular two cities, which are London and Paris. And in Paris, it opens with the traumatized Dr. Manette being released from the Bastille after 18 years of imprisonment and hard shoemaking. He is reunited with his daughter Lucy, who has been raised as a ward of Tellison's Bank by manager Jarvis Laurie and governess Miss Pross. Father and daughter are reunited in the wine bar of Monsieur and Madame Defarge, two dour peasants whose animus towards the aristocracy will soon come to a head. Back in London, the French expatriate Charles Darnay is on trial for espionage. Dr. Manette testifies on his behalf, but what really gets him exonerated is the fact that Sidney Carton, a drunk and nihilistic barrister, looks just like him, bringing into question the eyewitness testimony. Darnay, now free, returns to France to repudiate his secret aristocratic heritage and trade barbs with his uncle, the Marquis, who does stuff like run peasant boys down in the street, only to be killed in his sleep by the dead child's father. Darnay sets the family estate up in trust, hoping to eventually give it to the peasantry because he's just that good. In London, Darnay falls in love with Lucy. Carton falls in love with Lucy. A frumpy old barrister falls in love with Lucy. Dickens falls in love with Lucy and wants all of his readers to fall in love with her too. But she marries Darnay and has a daughter and a son who dies in the most irritatingly pathetic way possible.
Oh, yeah.
Carton pines after her from afar. In the meantime, back in France, the Bastille has fallen, and Monsieur and Madame Defarge are leaders in a brutal group of revolutionaries. Madame Defarge has been keeping a record of all the enemies of the New Republic by keeping a secret code in her knitting. The steward that Darnay has left in charge of the estate is arrested, and Darnay, who is not that smart, heads back to France to try to get him released. Instead, he's imprisoned. Lucy, Manette, Miss Pross, and Laurie go to the tribunal in Paris to argue on Darnay's behalf. It seems as though Dr. Manette's vouching will free Darnay, but the Defarges present a letter that they found in Manette's old cell, in which the doctor condemns his imprisoners and their descendants, who unfortunately in this case were the late Marquis and by extension Darnay himself. But wait, Sidney Carton has also been slinking around Paris, and by blackmail and drugging, he is able to enter Darnay's cell and switch places with the prisoner, who is whisked away unconscious. Madame Defarge and Miss Pross have a crazy fight, which leaves the revolutionary unable to knit. Everyone escapes back to London except Carton, who does a far, far better thing.
That was great. That was a great job.
And of course, I've left out a ton of minor characters, including this crazy resurrection man who works for the bank.
Jerry Cruncher is, I think, one of the weirdest elements of the book for me. I remember when I read this the first time, I pretty much immediately knew what his secret was. And on the second reading, I didn't realize, I had forgotten how much he actually evolves as a character and has this strange redemption at the end of the book. And I was trying to figure out, like, what is the point of this grave robber? I mean, he figures into the plot in an unexpected way toward the very end of the book. But I wasn't sure if he was supposed to be some sort of commentary on the day and on the peasantry. He does get a kind of interesting speech at the end that he delivers to Mr. Laurie about how he's an honest tradesperson and the doctors are sort of benefiting from the dirty work that he does. And no one looks down on them. And so there's some interesting class stuff going on with Jerry, but he's also kind of abusive to his wife. In what's supposed to be, I think, a comic relief. But it reads pretty awkwardly, these days.
Well, what I think he's there for is the central symbol of this book is resurrection. The first chapter is called Recalled to Life. And that's where Dr. Manette is brought out of the land of the dead. And everything about this book is about people finding redemption in horrible circumstances. It's about being swept up in the course of history, and if you're a good person, you're able to make your sacrifice mean something. And so of course the major sacrifice of the book is Sidney Carton giving his life for Charles Darnay and Lucy to have a family together. It's a strange victory in a way that Carton, his sense of self-worth is, I've so debased myself, the only way that I can be valuable in the world is to sacrifice myself. But that's kind of central to Dickens' view of what's happening in this book, because this is all taking place, of course, in the context of the terrible bloodshed of the Revolution. And this is written in 1859, so if you know a little bit about the history of France after the Revolution, they've gone through they went through the Revolution, the First Republic, there was Napoleon, there was the Bourbon Restoration, there was the July Monarchy, the Second Republic, and then the Second Empire at this point. So we've gone through an awful lot in France Dickens's readership would be only too aware of. the other thing that I think is important is England itself had gone through civil war in the 17th century and had lost its American colonies in the 18th century. The threat of uprising, the threat of unrest,
yes,
all through this book is Dickens is addressing the reader to look at what happened in France and to compare it to what's happening in present day Victorian England, in a kind of an interestingly almost a Marxist way. It's sort of like, this is what the natural result is of oppression. This is like, if the aristocracy treats the peasantry this way, they will do this, and there's nothing anyone can do. The weird thing is, Dickens's view of history seems to be so mechanistic and so devoid from passing judgment on individuals, and yet the plot is about people being either villains or incredibly noble.
Yeah, it's very difficult. I think one of the confusing things tonally about Tale of Two Cities is that Dickens is, of course, pretty harsh, harshly critical of the wealthy classes and the ruling classes, and he's harshly critical of England as well. There were parts of this where, particularly in the beginning, where he's talking about some of the methods of punishment in England, and he's the Dickens that you know, the kind of social critic, and pointing out brutality and pointing out hypocrisy. But then he's also, of course, extremely critical of the sort of brutality and lack of mercy that that Madame Lafarge and the peasantry are enacting. And it's hard to get a sense. I mean, he certainly is very critical, or paints the Marquis as this brutal, terrible person, and he is. He's a brutal, terrible character whose carriage runs down a child in the street, and he shows no sympathy or remorse. So I think what's peculiar is just trying to get a handle on where Dickens's sympathies lie. He is sympathetic with individuals, and of course not with the mob, which, you know, I suppose he shouldn't be. But I think it makes the book feel a little uneven for me. Like I'm trying to locate, you know, where the author's judgment is, and I think it maybe even shifts a good bit. And I feel like he uses the Defarges to shift his sort of apparent sympathies across the course of the novel. Because where they are when we meet them is a pretty different place than where they end up.
There is a strong parallel between Dr. Manette and Madame Defarge, which is both are characters who have been exceedingly wronged by the system of the French aristocracy. Madame Defarge has every right to hate the aristocracy. You know, the Marquis killed and raped these,
yeah,
this young family, and that's how Manette gets thrown to prison, we learn.
And the reveal on that is amazing. I mean, it's so late in the story, and it's so shocking and horrifying. It's pretty intense. I'm sure that his readers were, by that point, their jaws were probably on the floor.
Right, but the difference between them is who is able to find it in their souls to move on. Who's able to let go and say, well, there was an injustice. That doesn't mean that vengeance has to be chased to the end of the world. And what's the irony, of course, is that it's Dr. Manette's angry letter written in the first days of his imprisonment that is going to get Darnay decapitated, and but he's moved on since then, and the mechanism that Dickens wants us to think is motivating everybody in the book who has a change of heart is changed by knowing Lucy. You know, the second section of the book is written in these different sections that are given titles, is called The Golden Thread, and that is a metaphor that refers to Lucy, who has blonde hair, who is sweet and gentle and obedient and a good daughter and a loving wife and a loving mother, and everyone who comes in contact with her wants to be a better person. And so when it's her attentions that bring Dr. Manette out of the torpor, the shock of having been basically in isolation all these years. It's her example that makes Carton want to become a better person than he is, even though he has no expectations of ever winning her love. But Lucy is such a dull character.
Yeah. There's not a lot there beyond the sort of flat, sweet. It's really hard to get a grip on her as a person, as a human being with any kind of depth. Which I think is a shame, because Dickens can write very interesting female characters and does all the time. I think even of Estelle from Great Expectations, and the main character whose name I can't remember from Bleak House, who I really love, and some of his women who are hiding a secret past, or women like Madame Defarge, who is incredibly, at least has this vitality and focus to her. And strength, like just kind of physical strength, which comes off the page in a really real way. I think it's disappointing to have a heroine like Lucy, who's so hard for a modern reader. And again, returning to a high school student, I mean, I think if I was a high school girl reading this book, I would throw it across the room, because she's so frustrating and hard to relate to, from, you know, our position in the 21st century.
Well, that has to do with Victorian ideals of womanhood. There's a kind of a cult of innocence that surrounds the perfect woman in the Victorian period.
Yes, like infantilizing sort of this, like the woman as perpetual child, or an angel on earth. Yeah.
You mentioned other Dickens characters. Certainly, Madame Defarge is the most compelling character, I think, in this book. But if you go to like a book like Oliver Twist, a character like Nancy is much more compelling as a allegedly fallen woman by Victorian standards, who is able to act in a maternal role towards Oliver. I mean, that's still a kind of a cliche. That's the cliche of the prostitute with a heart of gold, but she's just such a more interesting character, and she's just given a much more of a voice. Lucy has almost no voice. When she's told that her father is still alive, she faints. You know, that's kind of like who she is. And she can't believe when Sidney Carton tells her that he can't become anything better in life, and she tries to coax him out of his miserable existence, which apparently means he goes to a bar once in a while and plays cards. I'm not sure. He doesn't really seem to be leading all that debauched life to me.
Well, yeah, he drinks a lot, and he hangs out. I guess he stays up all night. walking around the streets, and he also hangs around her house quite a bit, and sort of envies her life with her domestic bliss. He seems very dashing. I think he's one of those characters who's far more interesting. You're just like, oh, why didn't you go out with Sydney? He's much more interesting than Charles.
Right. Well, he gets to at least make some funny, snarky comments, at least until he gets all moony over Lucy and kind of loses his edge.
Yeah, he is a little bit more interesting before he kind of falls in love and just becomes sort of like a lap dog in a way.
Yeah, and then his whole plot to save Darnay at the end of the novel is quite he's quite active as a character. You know, he's the guy who's actually pulling all the strings and getting everything done at the end of this novel. But it's amazing how quickly that all happens. I forgot. I thought Sydney was in this book more than he is, but he isn't really.
He disappears for quite some time. And the funny thing about that end, like all of that stuff that happens is like hinges on a number of, you know, Dickensian coincidences and secret identities and people popping up in places where they are not really expected to be, and him knowing and him recognizing people and putting things together. So he can't be that much of a drunk because he actually seems pretty sharp. When he needs to recall a face or a name, he seems to be able to do it.
I like what you say about all the coincidences, because this is, I think, ultimately one of the biggest problems I have with the novel. Is this is a book that's supposed to be taking place in a backdrop of history, and yet it's filled with all those crazy melodramatic reveals and twists of fate that mark Dickens' purely fictional novels.
Yeah, it's pretty classic in that regard. You know, that it has his little trademark coincidental identities. Absolutely.
That doesn't really work together in this weird way, because I was looking at my notes here. One of the sections where Dickens talks about what happened in France, there's a part where he says, and it was too much the way of native British orthodoxy to talk of this terrible revolution as if it were the only harvest ever known under the skies that had not been sown, as if nothing had ever been done or admitted to be done that had led to it, as if observers of the wretched millions of France and of the misused and perverted resources that should have made them prosperous had not seen it inevitably coming years before and had not in plain words recorded what they saw. It's this kind of, again, this kind of highly mechanistic vision of there is no coincidence here about what happened in the revolution. And yet Carton and Darnay looking exactly alike, and that being the linchpin upon which this whole book kind of like turns at the end, that's ridiculous. And the fact that he gains entrance to Darnay's cell, as you say, because he recognizes this character who's only been mentioned earlier in the book, you know, maybe 300 pages ago. And again, we're supposed to remember who that was. Darnay is held up as a good member of the aristocracy because he's just so good, and the Marquis is just so bad, and there's no one who's just so middle of the road, you know? There's no one who's like, he wasn't that great with his peasants, but, you know, he gave money to charity from now and then.
I just want to return quickly to what you were saying about Charles and Sydney. Their remarkable identical appearance, which some characters seem to notice and some don't. Sydney ends up in the wine shop, and Madame Defarge is like, oh man, he looks so much like Charles Darnay. But other people in the wine shop don't seem to perceive that. And after the trial at the beginning, where it's it's used basically to free their resemblance to each other is used to free Charles, the trial in England, that is. No one really talks about it that much after that. So it again, it's one of those things that Dickens uses, and then it sort of gets subsumed, and it doesn't come back up again until it is really important, and until he needs it to come back up. And it sounds to me like the biggest difference between them is that maybe Sidney wears his hair down, and his hair is often disordered, and maybe Charles ties his hair back more, and is neater, and maybe more clean shaven. I don't know. I'm not totally totally clear on that.
Well, we presume that Charles has a French accent, maybe. But the thing that when you said that Madame Defarge recognizes it, what that makes me think of is the fact that Madame Defarge is taking notes on everyone who's coming into her shop in her knitting. She's got this code, we're told, that allows her to not just write down names into her knitting, but to keep records such as how tall someone is and whether or not they are friendly and whether they speak with a lisp.
I never took that very literally. Like I just assumed that it was, I don't know. Like, is that something that she's actually doing, or is that something that's sort of projected? Cause I don't know how you would knit someone's name into a thing without it being obvious. So I guess I read that as a very like poetic, sort of heightened poetic device.
Now that you say it, it could be metaphorical, as in she's knitting it in sort of a mindful. She's stowing these things.
Oh
away.
Yeah, I love that mindful knitting. That's really great. I like the idea of her mindfully knitting her anger into this long scarf or whatever she's making, a shroud.
But I don't know. I think this time when I was reading it through, I thought that Dickens really wanted us to literally think that there is some manner of code, because there's a point where Monsieur Defarge is talking to someone else and saying that my wife can put this all down into what she's knitting. And there's a sequence where some people come into the bar and they look at her suspiciously and they say, what is that thing you're doing? It doesn't seem to be making any sense. It's just long and straggly. And they're saying, would you ever use it? And she goes, oh, I'll find a use for it someday.
Yes.
It's all supposed to be very dire. But the thing that's ridiculous about this is knitting is basically there's two ways you go with knits. You have a knit and you have a purl. And by combining those two together, you can create all these different kinds of stitches in knitting. You know, if you have one knit and one purl, or if you have one knit and two purls and whatever, you create these different weaves. But they're basically two kinds of knit. And that kind of roughly corresponds to binary code, I suppose, but I can't imagine actually sitting there and doing that. I also just don't know where someone's name begins or ends this thing. I mean, it's a funny idea, but
right. It's like a scroll. Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah, I mean, it logically makes no sense. I don't think you can't really make sense of how she would. I think she just does have like a photographic memory, and maybe she just says it's all in her. It's all being recorded in her knitting. Who knows? It's very weird.
But it is an arresting image, and it's of course the talisman.
Well, it's the ceaselessness of it. I think that's the cool thing about it. It's this sort of nervous action of the hands, and the ceaselessness of the labor that makes it so compelling. And it's also this domestic art, which is turned into a kind of like record keeping and witnessing. So I think in that regard, it seems incredibly sort of feminist to me. And I probably shouldn't use that word, because that wouldn't have been Dickens' intention in any way, but I like that about it, that it's this sort of benign domestic art that is transformed into something deadly and threatening. It's very exciting.
I agree with everything you said there. And the other thing that, as you were saying that, it made me think of is Penelope in the Odyssey weaving,
yes,
and unweaving, because that's another case of a woman using a domestic art in a crafty and strategic way.
Yes, with agency.
Those are the reasons why I think, of course, everyone loves Madame Defarge. Now, Madame Defarge has this crazy showdown at the end with Miss Pross. It's such a weird thing because it's so unexpected to have.
And
in
they
a Dickens
don't understand
novel.
Each other. They're talking to each other, but not like Miss Pross speaks not a word of French. We're told earlier when we're given that scene where she's at, where she goes, where we're shown how she goes out grocery shopping and just expects people to understand what she wants and how she deals with the shopkeepers in France. And she's the consummate Englishwoman. And she's the perfect servant. Like she's incredibly devoted to Lucy. She's been, I don't know how, I guess Tellson's has been paying her for all these years. It's unclear to me, exactly why she's as loyal as she is, but she's a really wonderful character. And so there, she's speaking to Madame Defarge in English. Madame Defarge is speaking to her in French. There are times where they seem to have a supernatural understanding of each other. And it's almost like these national identities are going head to head. Like I sort of love the way they personify what I guess Dickens' idea of England and maybe France at that time are, and how that showdown kind of plays out. And it's, and they are, I love Miss Pross so much. She is a better, I think she's a certainly a better female character, more interesting than Lucy, because she is a spinster, and because she has a lot of character. She talks back a good bit. She always stands up to Mr. Jarvis Lorry, who is also a wonderful character. But I like how she's sassy with him, and how sometimes she'll say something to him and he'll be just dumbstruck. He doesn't know how to respond. I think very early in the novel, there's this scene where she says something like, "You call that banking?" And he doesn't know what to say. And it's just really funny. I think, I love when Charles Dickens is funny, and I think he's not maybe given credit often enough for being as humorous as he can be.
I agree exactly with what you say about this being a showdown of national identity. And I think that Dickens is contrasting what is often seen as a foible of the British character. It's fussiness, its attention, its devotion to class, its devotion to tradition, and the sense of absolute loyalty is demanded at all times of everyone, against what is often seen as the cliche is that France as a Mediterranean country is more driven by passion and emotion. And so as a showdown, it's an interesting one. And it's also an interesting one because Pross comes from what is the British peasant class. And she has been a servant all her life, but she has been, in Dickens' eyes, has been treated well and justly by her superiors. The Brits get to hold on to their class system and feel good about it as long as they don't fall into the excesses that led to the French Revolution. it's actually a fairly tense piece of writing and a fairly funny piece of writing, which is interesting because this is a book where that more than most Dickens, people are in threat of their lives a lot in this book. That's not often the case in Dickens, actually. Dickens, you know, when we think about things like Great Expectations or David Copperfield, these are these buildings romans that are, you know, people are facing the dilemma of will they make their fortune in the world, you know. But I don't think that the same kind of existential threat run through those books. And yet, I didn't find myself worried a lot in this book. Probably because I didn't care too much about people, but I did care about both Miss Pross and Madame Defarge. I wanted to see who was going to win this fight.
Yeah. Well, only one person can win, really.
Yeah. When I finished reading this, it made me think of War and Peace, because that's a book that was published 10 years after this about a roughly around the same time. I mean, the War and Peace goes from 1805 to like 1820 and covers the Napoleonic era of France and of Russia. And that's a book that I think much more skillfully weaves actual history into the intersection of people's lives. And part of that is because Tolstoy is actually writing fully rounded characters who have a lot of crazy foibles, and it is about aristocracy and peasantry, you know, and how they navigate this time of upheaval. And I think that would be an interesting comparison to make.
I haven't read it at all, so yeah.
That's a longer book than this is by far. And, of course, with Tolstoy, the issue is always figuring out who everybody is because of all the
because
crazy
they have
Russian...
like six names. They have four different. Yeah. And there's a bunch of Nikolais.
Exactly. But I would recommend it because I find that actually an easier read than this. Basically, because I like the characters in that book more than I like them in this book. But I think... I think it's an interesting if I put that out there to our listeners, anyone who wants to compare two Victorian era novels about the long French 19th century, try reading those two books together.
Oh, what a feat. What a feat that would be. I'll think about it. I really actually want to reread Bleak House now that I've gone through Tale of Two Cities, because I think Bleak House is my favorite Dickens, my favorite like longer Charles Dickens novel.
And I would say my favorite will probably always be Great Expectations, because of all the things we've said before, as you mentioned, Estella is just so much more interesting as a character.
Oh, she's a wonderful character. She changes. We really get to see her change, and she's complicated, and she's not very likable, but you really sympathize with her because she's just a young girl kind of being warped by this completely sick person that, you know, if it were present day, she probably would have been hopefully taken away from Miss Havisham by social services. Who knows? Maybe not. She's just really much more compelling.
And that's a story that I think starts very in kind of a simplistic story about Miss Havisham wanting revenge on the world and Pip harboring this fugitive from the law. It starts out with a kind of a moral world that's very black and white, and by the end of the novel everything is gray and everything is mixed up, and nobody and Pip has no sense of whether the fortune he's arrived at has, you can say, he deserves it or not, or whether the world is fair or not. And the eventual relationship between him and Estella is so mitigated and complicated. And that's what I like about that, is that's a Dickens novel that starts like a regular Dickens novel and ends up like something else entirely.
Yes. Whereas Tale of Two Cities ends up pretty much exactly where I think you would think it would end. And we're even given this sort of forecasting into the future, which I had completely forgotten, where, you know, we see sort of Lucy, you know, bearing another boy, and the boy is named for Sidney Carton, and Sidney Carton is sort of redeemed through this through these children, the son that Lucy bears, and then his son. So his redemption is sort of carried forward into time, which is a really funny. I didn't remember it at all, and it seems kind of strange, and very sentimental.
I see the lives for which I lay down my life, peaceful, useful, prosperous and happy in that England which I shall see no more. I see her with a child upon her bosom who bears my name. I see her father, aged and bent, but otherwise restored and faithful to all men in his healing office and at peace. I see the good old man, so long their friend, in 10 years' time enriching them with all he has and passing tranquilly to his reward. I see that I hold a sanctuary in their hearts and in the hearts of their descendants, generations hence. I see her, an old woman, weeping for me on the anniversary of this day. I see her and her husband, their course done, lying side by side in their last earthly bed, and I know that each was not more honored and held sacred in the other's soul than I was in the souls of both. I see that child who lay upon her bosom and who bore my name, a man winning his way up in that path of life which once was mine. I see him winning it so well that my name is made illustrious there by the light of his. I see the blots I threw upon it faded away. I see him, foremost of just judges and honored men, bringing a boy of my name with a forehead that I know and golden hair to this place, then fair to look upon, with not a trace of this day's disfigurement. And I hear him tell the child my story with a tender and a faltering voice. It is a far, far better thing that I do than I have ever done. It is a far, far better rest that I go to than I have ever known.
It is very sentimental, but it's also an attempt to find redemption for all of France, you know, which, again, by this time has gone through a half dozen major revolutions since the events of this novel, and people must be starting to feel like, is anything ever going to work out for France again?
You're right, because it's also a redemption of Darnay's line, in a way.
Right.
Which is the Marquis' line. So, I hadn't thought of it that way. It does sort of redeem the family of the Marquis, and it redeems Carton as well, which I guess is right. another way that the mirroring of those two characters happens.
It is a highly sentimental ending, with Carton talking to his fellow prisoner on the way to the guillotine.
We get another sort of very poor, innocent, downtrodden female who's too good for this earth.
Well, she's not going to be in it long. But it does end, of course, on one of the most famous lines in Dickens, it is a far, far better thing that I do now than I have ever done. It is a far, far better rest that I go to than I have ever known. And which is funny, because this is also a novel that has
the most famous beginning. Yes, I was thinking the same thing as I was preparing for this podcast and kind of reflecting on the novel. I was like trying to remember. You know, I didn't read this novel until maybe my mid-30s. But of course, the first chapter and the end are incredibly famous, and I must have known about them years and years and years ago. And I was trying to remember if I have a vague recollection that we maybe had the Classics Illustrated version, and that's where I first would have read or at least flipped through. I don't remember reading the Classics Illustrated. I would have been pretty young, but I remember I've looked up images of it, but I can't tell based on my very shaky memory whether that's a true memory. I know exactly kind of what the cover looks like and what it looks like as Carton is mounting the guillotine steps and kind of like wistfully looking backward. And you know, I have a memory of that from maybe being 5 or 6 or 7, but like I said, I don't know if it's a real memory, but the ending and the idea of his sacrifice is so, I don't know, almost ingrained, culturally somehow, that I knew it long before I got to actually reading the novel itself.
Well, both the opening and the ending are some of the most self-consciously poetic writing that Dickens ever does. They're full of parallelism, of all these things that we associate more with poetry than we do with prose, or the kind of you know what they sound like is they sound like Winston Churchill's aphorisms. They rely on chiasmus and that sort of thing. It's that Dickens narrative voice that comes in and is going to tell you exactly what everything means, which is such a fascinating thing to, I think, a modern reader, where we're so used to either not having any narrative voice at all, like that's going to tell us what things are, or we're used to unreliable narrators. We're used to the narrator that's going to tell us something, and we're invited to disagree with them. But this is like, we're supposed to, you know, as good Victorian English people reading this book, we're supposed to absolutely be right there for Dickens and crying a tear at these moments.
Yeah, so. I enjoy it a lot of times, particularly when he's being funny and when he's being kind of tongue in cheek. It's very fun. You feel like you're in the author's confidence. It is a really different thing to have an author that you're just supposed to trust implicitly and go along with them when they're being sort of grand. When they are being very, I guess, highfalutin with their language, or telling you exactly what you should think and what you should feel.
Yeah, the thing I find most charming about Dickens is when he goes full on God mode, and there's parts of Great Expectations where he's describing London. And if you're the kind of person who can't take descriptions, you'll hate them. But if you're the kind of person who loves descriptions, they go on and on. He's just kind of like going through the streets of London, describing everything. And it's wonderful. And there's also a sequence in A Christmas Carol, which is my favorite sequence of the whole book, where they go out to a ship at sea.
Yes.
Do you know?
Yeah, it's the Ghost of Christmas Present, right?
Right.
And he's kind of whizzing Scrooge all over the world in his cloak. And it's so beautiful. They go out. Yeah, they visit all these people who are celebrating Christmas, and they go to these like hovels, and they go out to a ship or a lighthouse or something, and it's so beautiful. It's my favorite part too, because you kind of feel the darkness of the night, and you can see the little lights of these tiny little places where people are gathered. You can just see it in your mind's eye, and I guess Scrooge is protected. Like, it would be incredibly cold, but you know, he's got his own little like personal bubble, sort of carrying him around the world. It's really, it is really beautiful. I love that part too.
Well, we've talked a lot about other Dickens books. Any final words about this book before we close the pages here?
Any final words? Well, I guess I would just say, if you read it once and you didn't like it, try reading it again. I think it improves on upon further reading. I don't think that Lucy and Darnay are ever going to be entirely satisfactory to the reader. But I think it's really Mr. Jarvis Laurie is so adorable and wonderful, and I love Dickens' first description of his wig and of how his pants fit, and I think it's worth it just for that. And there's some really beautiful sharp-eyed things that he does when he's talking about kind of the ground-down life of the French peasantry. There's some landscape stuff that he does that is that feels incredibly harsh. And I think the scenes, the three scenes in the middle that sort of dwell on the marquee are really pointed and wonderful. So there's a lot in here to love. And it was also, of course, very interesting sort of reading it as we're going through some things in this country that feel pretty pinching toward you know, the working class and the middle class and the working poor, and you know, it was just interesting to be reading it and to be thinking about a lot of the pressures in this country right now between the wealthiest people and the people with the least. So I'm not going to say too much more about that, but I think it's worth a visit for that as well.
Thanks to co-host Roslyn Vastias. Her collection of poetry, Only Blue Body, is available from Anhinga Press. The excerpt was read by Anthony Johnston. His podcast, Unjustly Maligned, is available from the Incomparable Network. Hey, that's my network. Check out more podcasts at theincomparable.com. Join in the discussion on the Sophomore Lit Facebook page, or write at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. And keep up the reading. Everything will be on the final.